Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm and ZipRecruiter. Joining us is our good friend, Tom Nichols. Thanks for coming back, Tom. I appreciate it very, very much.
Good to be back with you, Charlie.
You're getting it from both ends these days. So let's just jump right into this, because you had a column in USA Today, and I have to admit that the reaction to it is as interesting as the column. No disrespect to the column, which I thought was extremely interesting, where the headline they put on it was basically, look, do we still agree on beating Trump? Are you Democrats actually serious about winning this election? Because after that LGBTQ forum, I'm not sure. You feel like you've written enough of these, you know, tough love columns to the Democrats, and that they're not having it.
Yeah, they don't want to hear that, and I think it's in part because they know that some of this is not a good idea. They don't want to admit that they still have to win some votes that from people they may not actually care that much about. But I also think that they're kind of, you know, it's almost like they're reacting to me like I'm being a buzzkill, because I think deep down they really believe that Trump simply could not possibly win. Right. And the only thing that's left to argue about is what flavor of woke we're going to replace Donald Trump with. And I think it's way too early to be, you know, celebrating and doing the victory dance, because I think Trump is going to be impeached. I think he's going to survive impeachment, and I think he actually has a good shot at reelection.
Okay, so I would like to provide, you know, some optimism. I would like to cheer you up, but I'm nobody ever comes to me for that. Nobody ever comes to me for optimism here. So you want some tough love though, Tom?
Wait on me.
You're not sure about that. I noticed the long pause there.
I know. I feel like I'm trying to form a coalition with people here, and they keep dumping on me. And you know, Charlie, you've got to speak some comfort to me here.
Okay. No comfort. I didn't say comfort. I said tough love, because it turned out you were too cheap a date. See, you were out there on the street corner. You were flaunting it too early. You basically wrote all the pieces saying, "I'm with you guys no matter what you do." I mean, you give me the socialists, I'm there. You give me Elizabeth Warren and her bans on fracking and her, you know, abolition of private insurance, and I'm voting. I'm voting for any Democrat, pretty much, except for Tulsi Gabbard or something like all of that.
I'm a better Democrat than most Democrats.
Right. So now you're worried that you're not getting respect. But you gave it away for free. You know what I'm saying? you were giving away the milk for free.
I don't think that's the problem. I don't think that, you know, first of all, I don't think the Democrats really care about Never Trumpers and the disaffected Republicans. And I thought it was important to say early on that Never Trump means Never Trump, because I think one of the things that's really, you know, aggravated me are the people who say, well, you say you're Never Trump, but don't you mean really unless? And I mean, no, I mean, never means never. And I think Donald Trump is an existential threat. And if you believe Donald Trump is an existential threat, you have to act like it. And this is where I really came down on the Democrats. They're not acting like Donald Trump is an existential threat. So I actually don't want them to pander to me. I don't want them to try to gain my vote. I don't want them to think that they have to triangulate to get me. What I want them to do is not scare enough people in about four or five states into going from a Democratic vote to no vote at all. And one of the things that was most upsetting about the reaction to this article are the people who accused me of telling the Democrats that they needed to go out and convert Trump voters. I don't think they need to do that. I don't think that's possible. But what the Democrats may end up doing is turning people that would have voted Democrats into stay-at-home voters.
Yeah, and you made this point, this nationally televised LGBTQ town hall meeting. You said it looked like a beauty contest aimed at increasing fundraising among a wealthy Democratic demographic, but at the risk of alienating the African-American and suburban women who propelled you into the majority in 2018, did you really need a primary-driven bidding war to see who could be more demonstratively empathetic and accepting? Or, I guess I would add, sneering. And this is the point that people don't, I guess if you stay long enough in the bubble, you don't understand why so many people were offended by Elizabeth Warren suggested that anybody who had traditional religious views about marriage, you know, should be mocked as what a basically an incel that you know you're obviously a guy living in your mother's basement watching porn because you're never going to get a real woman. And it's like, well, wait, you know, the country is, you know, is certainly sympathetic to your position on this, but African Americans are not. They're 50-50, and there's at least a third of voters out there that are just not, you know, ready to come along. And it was the insulting, sneering tone of it that I think was so jarring to people outside the bubble.
One of the other things that I think was really, for me, off-putting about the reaction to my piece was that people immediately started piling in on me and saying, oh, so you think we have to pander to people who don't care about gay rights, which is just a stupid reaction. That's just an intentional misreading of the piece, because what Warren did was not really raise the issue of whether or not marriage equality matters. Although, again, I think, you know, saying that your reaction to someone who believes that marriage is one man, one woman, is that this is clearly a guy who can't get a woman, which I thought was an unnecessarily clearly, by the way, she practiced that line. You could see it. I mean, any political staffer, any consultant could see that this was, she was waiting to unload that line, and she was really proud of herself for the way she hauled that off with her timing. But what she did was reopen the problem that she's going to run as a out of touch Cambridge professor elitist. I mean, this is why among a broad swath of Americans, a word like Harvard is an insult. That professor, you know, I'm speaking as a professor, you know, this is why a lot of people think the word professor means, you know, the enemy, because she really just came across as, as you say, it was just sneering. I mean, it was just this kind of smug, deprecating. I call it the Deplorables 2.0 moment.
It really was
needless.
Well, you know, and Arthur Brooks makes the point about if you want to persuade someone, the thing to avoid is that eye rolling contempt, the expression of contempt, because then all persuasion ends. But what was really interesting to watch was the way that the Warren campaign thought this was brilliant. Most of the media folks thought it was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was interesting that the Washington Post did do a story basically saying, hey, you know, not everybody heard that in the same way. So let's just talk about the Democratic field, because you're kind of down on them.
Before we leave that piece, I think I should add that there was another piece written the same day, independently of me, by Katie Herzog at The Stranger, a Seattle newspaper, that said the only winner of that town hall was Donald Trump. Katie Herzog is a young, progressive, gay woman. So, you know, my message to the Democrats is when the old conservative guy in Rhode Island and the young progressive gay woman in Washington see this the same way, maybe you ought to listen to the possibility that you made a mistake here.
The fact that you can, you know, the names of the people who agreed with you is a little bit troubling. You know, I mean,
you got so much the phone booth.
Somebody said, you know, never Trump is big enough to have a dinner party, not actually to form an actual political party. OK, so let's talk about the state of the Democratic race, because you're feeling a little bit concerned. The Joe Biden situation, you know, it is interesting to me that even among people who should know better, there's this sense of, you know, when is Joe Biden going to come clean? And this is what's making at least my head hurt. And I talked about this with A.B. Stoddard as well. It's the kind of the brazenness that we actually have Don Jr. out there going, you know what, I'm going to take gaslighting to a whole new level and mock the Bidens for nepotism.
Yeah.
It's like, because you won't notice what's going on here, right? You have a president who is engaging in almost hourly impeachable acts of corruption, and yet much of our political debate and dialogue is taken up with how's Joe Biden going to deal with his corruption allegations.
Well, I think a couple of things are going on here. And one of them is, I think there's a fair number of people in the media who really wish Joe Biden would just get out of the way, because they'd really like to clear the path for a more progressive candidate. Not necessarily a younger candidate, you understand, but a more progressive candidate. I also think that there is this kind of over overexertion of both sides of them to say, you know, well, we hold our own people to account, so Joe Biden has to come clean. You know, I think it's clear what happened with the Bidens, that, you know, Hunter Biden is one of the many children of famous people who made money off his name. Never an attractive thing. Swampy. Great. The end. Meanwhile, the president is committing impeachable acts at such a rate that we literally can't keep up. There aren't enough breaking news chyrons in the world to constantly keep us abreast of how many impeachable things per day the president is doing. And everybody's worried about this, you know, Biden situation. But it's, again, it's because I think the media, both, again, because of their own biases about Biden, but also because they're kind of snake bit about, you know, taking to heart that, you know, we're not tough on all the candidates in the same way. And I think it's just, I think there's that third problem, that Democrats are just bad at politics, to say, hey, look, we're going to clean our own house, and you talk about Ivanka, and we'll talk about Hunter, and that way we're all showing our cards here, as though these are even remotely comparable situations. The fact of the matter is, you know, this administration is in impeachable free fall, and frankly, I couldn't give a damn about Hunter Biden, and I don't think most people should either, unless there's really some indication that, you know, Joe Biden, that there was some, you know, abuse of power as vice president. And no one's alleging that. I mean, even Trump isn't alleging that. This is just an attempt to kind of splash dirt all over the place and see what happens. Whether that's going to take out Biden, I don't know. But I think it shows that no matter who the Democrats is, the Democratic nominee is, the institutional Democratic Party is once again, you know, bringing a Nerf bat to a gunfight, and they're just not ready for what they're going to have to be up against in 2020. And this is why, you know, I'm kind of have this hangdog sense that, you know, as awful as everything is going to be, and I think impeachment is the duty of the Democratic Congress at this point. I just wonder if Trump's just not going to be able to survive at all and waltz right through that Elizabeth Warren candidacy while she's trying to explain video of why she was talking to a 9-year-old at a gay, lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual town hall about why she would let him pick the next Secretary of Education. I mean, we really are in crazy town now.
Okay, let's talk about what's happening in the Middle East and whether it makes a difference, because we don't know. And I feel we've had this conversation many times before. Is this a breaking point? Does this change anything? And so far, the answer has been no and no and no and no. I'm sure you heard the president when he was sitting in the Oval Office with the Italian Prime Minister. And, you know, where do you even start with this? You know, says this conflict between Turkey and Syria rather than us was none of our business. And then sort of slurred the Kurds. They're no angels. They're no angels. Go back and take a look. They'd be fine. They're safe. They know how to fight. There's a lot of sand they can play with. It's possibly never going to be very stable. Essentially saying, yeah, if Russia wants to fill the gap, no problem. Now, and he says this while the vice president and the secretary of and the vice president is, you know, is on his way over there to try to broker some sort of a deal. And that whole trip turned out to be a complete fiasco. The House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to condemn his action. Lindsey Graham, once again, is finding his, I don't know, should we give Lindsey Graham credit for having a backbone? It seems like I'll regret it the moment I say it. But
no, now there's my tough love. Don't be weak, Charlie. Don't give in. We don't give Lindsey Graham credit for this, because the Republicans are already backtracking and saying, well, you know, we're just going to have to live with this, and it's a terrible thing. I mean, as you pointed out, Mike Pence is on his way to Turkey, and Erdogan's already said, you know, I don't think I need to talk to the vice president of the United States. There is no bottom here. I don't think that this is going to make a difference. Nothing else has made a difference. I don't see why this should. The Republicans are going to swallow this, because they're going to, you know, I'm sure Susan Collins is going to, you know, be deeply concerned and shake her head. And I mean, none of this is going to
matter. Pearls may be clutched.
Yeah, the institutional Republican Party is nothing more than a vehicle for a cult of personality. And the so-called moderate senators, you know, more than anything, they like being senators. They like being senators more than anything else in the world. And they're not going to do anything to endanger that. And if Donald Trump decides to sacrifice our allies on the altar of his own stupendous ignorance, well, if that's the price they got to pay to remain senators, that's what they're going to accept.
Well, the vote in the House of Representatives was 354-60, and four Republicans voted president. So that's kind of a, you know, at least it's symbolic. Let's go through the motions, rebuke of Trump. I guess I'm the one thing that surprises me, and this is like, you know, is this surprising or shocking? The thing that surprises me is that he makes this impulsive decision that turns out to be disastrous really quickly, that David Sanger leading the New York Times was really quite extraordinary about how quickly it went bad. And I think that there was a widespread expectation that with all of the blowback that he would fix it, that he would walk it back, that certainly he would not double down, that he wouldn't, you know, just, you know, add insult to injury with the Kurds, that he wouldn't be caught in public basically French kissing, you know, Vladimir Putin, you know, over Syria. And yet he's not, even though you have people like Lindsey Graham and evangelical Christian leaders like Pat Robertson who are railing against all of this. So are we in some new phase of just the pigheadedness of the president?
No. I mean, why would he? I mean, let's think about this for a moment. Why would he backtrack? What he has learned ever since the fiasco over the Mueller report is that no matter how damning the evidence, and certainly ever since, right? I mean, with Ukraine, no matter what comes out, these guys are going to have his back. I mean, this vote in the House, in some ways, that's worse than nothing at all, because that gives top cover to Republican Congress, members of Congress, who are now going to say, see, I call him out when I think he's wrong. But now that he's being impeached, I got to have his back. But I'm not a lapdog. I've once voted for a completely symbolic and meaningless thing to show that for 10 minutes I was deeply concerned about all the blood running in the streets. You know, this is, he has figured it out. He's figured out that he owns these guys lock, stock, and barrel. And that on anything substantive, when he says jump, they say how high. And on this, I think in some sense, the president's being perfectly rational. Why should he double? Why shouldn't he double down? What's Lindsey Graham? You know, he could pick up the phone and say, as he did today, you saw him when Lindsey Graham criticized him. He basically told Lindsey Graham that he's nothing but a neocon warmonger and he ought to shut up. So, you know, what are you going to do about it, Lindsey? I mean, Senator Graham says, I think this is terrible and the blood would be on this administration. They're very careful never to say Donald Trump. He said the blood would be on the administration's hands. And Donald Trump said, what are you going to do about it? Nothing.
Among the many extraordinary things about the president's comments were the way that they mirror the talking points from Erdogan, Putin, and Assad. You know, he says about the PKK, the Kurdish group, that it's probably worse a terror and more of a terrorist threat in many ways than ISIS. And he says Russia hates ISIS as much as the United States does. Syria hates ISIS. I mean, these are their talking points.
Right.
Wow.
Right. This is, you know, the only person who got it down with more rote repetition was Tulsi Gabbard during the debate talking about regime change wars. These are people who know their talking points. They know what these strong men want to hear. And they simply say it and repeat it. I mean, this is now a new formulation in American and international politics where you have a relationship that runs through the Republican Party to authoritarian leaders overseas. This is no longer a right-left formation in American politics. This is people in the United States of various political persuasions dealing with a Republican Party that at the very top is pretty much a wholly owned subsidiary of three or four strongmen around the world, from MBS to Erdogan to Putin.
And there's Kim Jong-un who's watching all of this with I'm sure a Cheshire cat grin. Okay, I think I can give a more positive spin on this. But before we do this, I want to get a word from our sponsor.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com.
Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/bulwark, B-U-L-W-A-R-K, ZipRecruiter.com/bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, we're back with Tom Nichols. Okay, so now you think this is a perfectly rational behavior by the president because he knows he's going to get away with it. Let me make a counter argument here that a lot of the things that are happening right now are different and really run counter to the president's preferred brand, including the fact that he looks weak, that the message of the irrelevance of the United States is becoming more and more apparent. That would be number one. Number two, that even though he promised to end the endless wars, people are seeing him betraying our allies and perhaps empowering the terrorists. And if there's one thing, one pillar of Trumpism is that I'm going to be the meanest son of a bitch on the block when it comes to protecting Americans against terror. And number three, we are now starting to see the crack in the wall of silence that's protected him so far. And we're starting to see members of this administration come forward. So these all seem to be things that have not happened until now.
Let me come back to that third thing, because I think that's important, the cracks in the wall. But the first two things I think are less important than you're giving them credit for. First, the image of weakness, that's really only among, you know, people like you and me, people who are national security related Republicans or who, you know, pay a lot of attention to foreign affairs. I think with the average, you know, member of the Republican base, they're going to say, I don't know who the Kurds are. I don't care who the Kurds are. You know, Turkey and Putin, you know, this is just part of the way things are done. The other problem is that, although I will say, let me make one exception. There are people in the military, I think, who have served with the Kurds. That argument's not going to fly. That's going to cost him. But I think there are also people out there who are just going to believe him when he gaslights them. He's going to say, the Kurds were bad guys. Turns out they were probably terrorists or no angels. And again, there's going to be a couple of guys, you know, the usual two guys in the diner that somebody's going to interview saying, you know, he's got a point. They were bad guys. We didn't need to be there because I don't really understand any of this. That third thing, though, that's interesting because that could cause I still don't think there's any circumstance under which the Senate convicts him. But I think when you have people that are going to come out, you know, you can see the preemptive attack on John Bolton. I mean, how weird that I'm going to sit here and defend John Bolton. But, you know, when John Bolton becomes the voice of ethical you know, sunlight and disinfectant for this White House. It tells you where they've gotten to. There are going to be, there could be enough people coming out of the woodwork that are going to reveal things that are such, so obviously crimes that, again, it could drive people not to change their support from Trump to a Democrat, but simply to quietly walk away from him, at least in the polls. Now, I think the Senate, the problem is for the Senate, it's still going to be about, you know, we want our judges, we want our tax cuts, we want the things we want from him. So, you know, now things could change. I mean, that was true about Richard Nixon right up until the summer of 1974. It could be that somewhere there's a phone call, a tape recording, something where, you know, even the most where even Susan Collins would have to change her mind.
Collins. Well, yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, it is pretty much, you know, abortion, guns, and judges. And you're right, about the MAGA base, that they will, in fact, go along with the president because that's what they do. And when he says that the Kurds are bad guys, you know, they're foreigners that are a long way away. And, of course, if the president says they're bad guys, maybe they are bad guys and we don't care. However, you said something that's important, though. Among active members of the military, they recognize what is going on. It is a real slap in the face. That's where I thought that Pete Buttigieg's performance during the debate was really interesting, because he was expressing that sense of betrayal. And when you take away, what was his line? You take away a soldier's honor, it's like taking away the body armor. I thought that was a very powerful line. Now, this is a constituency that has been pretty solidly pro-Trump, and the one that he certainly takes a great deal of pride in, and would be vulnerable if more people from the military began expressing those opinions, just like he's vulnerable if you have leaders of the evangelical Christian community. And again, you don't have to have, you know, huge movements of voters. His coalition is so fragile, you lose a bit of the military constituency and a bit of the evangelical Christian constituency, and that's bad news for him.
But I don't think that leads to him being convicted impeachment. No. But he could lose in 2020 based on that.
Yeah,
my only concern is, you know, this goes back to the, you know, to the things we were talking about with the Democrats in the primary, that the evangelicals, the military voters, the, you know, some of the heartland voters, they may well say, this guy is awful, and maybe I ought to just walk away. The problem is, you know, and then Elizabeth Warren, you know, steps forward and says, I'll ask a 9-year-old boy who I should, you know, appoint as Secretary of Education. And marriage between one man and one woman is for guys who can't, you know, can't meet a girl. And, you know, I'll take away your Medicare, and I won't tell you if I'm raising your taxes. I mean, at some point, you know, this plays right into the Republican messaging. Look, the Republicans are going to do this anyway, and I think we all get that. They're going to say the candidate's a socialist, and if you vote for Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, you're voting for, you know, vegan, Sharia law, socialist, abortion-loving, blah, 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 blah. The problem is, I think the Democrats are going to play right into that, and that could counteract within a year from now. That could counteract the shame, the horror, all of the things that Donald Trump is bringing on America right now. The only, I mean, I hate to say this as a bright side, but it may well be that none of that will matter in a year, because by then he will have done so many other ghastly and impeachable things that it may change the calculus then. But for now, they're not keeping the focus on Donald Trump, and I think that's really dangerous.
That is interesting, watching the Democratic debates, how little attention they sort of, every once in a while, will make sort of a gesture towards Trump, but that certainly has not been the focus. Okay, let's talk about impeachment for a moment. You and I agree on this, that he's not going to be removed from office. But in terms of timing, now, I had A.B. Stoddard on, and she's very passionate on the fact that Democrats are making a mistake by rushing impeachment. She says the Democrats should slow their roll for two reasons. Number one, because there's so much other stuff that's coming out all the time. Don't rush it. That's number one. Number two, you don't want to get this thing done by Thanksgiving, because that means that by the first of the year, everyone will forget about it. And she had a great point. She says, how many people remember that the president was going to invite the Taliban to Camp David for the anniversary of 9/11? Remember that story? No, nobody remembers that story, because we live in this time warp where we forget every freaking thing. And so her point is, if you rush it, you're going to feed the Republican sense that this thing is just a rush. It's about one phone call. You're not going to give yourself a time to get a sense, get your arms around how broad and deep this is. And number three, you'll do it so early that it will be completely forgotten by the time it matters when it comes to voting.
AB is a lot more astute and observer of politics than I am. So, you know, I take her point that, you know, if you do this thing by Christmas, then, you know, by the 4th of July next year, nobody remembers that the president was impeached. There's a couple of things.
By Valentine's Day, no one will remember.
Yeah, really, by Easter. But there's a couple of things to think about. First of all, I think before the 2020 election, I think every Republican senator should have to go on the record about how they voted. And so my concern is that if you roll this into 2020, a lot of Republicans are going to say, now that we're in an election year, I am just going to vote no, because this is clearly a Democratic election year stunt. And that's one of the reasons the Republicans, I think, are going to engage in dilatory, process-oriented obstructionism, because the Republicans want it to drag into 2020. They want this thing to limp into the year so that by the time you do impeach him, the American public is completely fed up with it, that they're bored with it, that they're annoyed with it, that they think it was just, you know, it becomes part of the wallpaper in the room, that the word impeachment just doesn't mean anything anymore. I think they need to get on with it. I think they need to do it. And I think they need to put everybody on the record to say, we had the charges, we had all the evidence we need. We didn't go on a fishing expedition or a witch hunt. We put these four or five articles. I've argued that you should basically stick to obstruction, abuse of power, emoluments, and campaign finance. Very easy to understand, straightforward. And then, you know, if this the Senate votes maybe sometime in January, February, I think the president, you know, completely loses his mind and does more impeachable things. But no matter how long you wait, this problem that he will overcome this with yet more outrageous behavior is going to be true no matter when it is. You could impeach him in October of 2020, and by Halloween, it will have been forgotten.
So when do you want to have the House vote on whether to impeach him? Not whether to open the inquiry, but the actual vote on impeachment. What would be the optimal date, do you think?
Well, first, I don't think there ought to be a vote on opening an inquiry. I think that's just a Republican delaying tactic. There's no requirement for that in the Constitution. You don't need to have a vote to have a vote.
Call their bluff, at least take away one of their talking points.
Yeah, but then when there's that vote, then there's going to be a debate, and then there's going to be the I was for it before I was against it. You know, enough games. We all know what's going to happen. The president has committed impeachable acts, and he should be impeached, period. Do your constitutional duty. Stop trying to innovate new solutions to a very clear remedy that's in the Constitution. If it were up to me, they would have the House would before, maybe not before Thanksgiving, but that wouldn't bother me at all. I mean, they could do it tomorrow for all I care, certainly before December, before the holidays, I think that'll send this off to the Senate, and then let the Senate go home for the holidays and listen to their constituents about what kind of trial they ought to run, how they ought to vote. And then in January or February, they'll have trial in the Senate. And as we head into the spring, no matter how it turns out, it's done. And for the whole rest of that time, every time a senator goes on television, they can run a Chiron that says voted for or voted against the president's impeachment. Because from then on, the president is running for re-election as a formally impeached president. And I'll add one other thing. I think that all you need are 6 Republican votes to make it a majority, so that for the rest of this campaign, the president has to live with the reality that he was impeached by the House and that there was a majority to convict. Because then, you know, at that point, what's his campaign slogan? Trump 2020. They couldn't get 2/3.
Let's talk about the world that we live in now post-Syria. I want to switch gears because I know this is something that you think about a great deal. You know, I'm thinking through what happened just in the last news cycle where President Erdogan, you know, vowing to continue this Turkish offensive against the Syrian Kurds, he rebuffs Trump's call for a truce in Syria, you know, demand that the Kurdish fighters disarm with the comments that the president made. It looked earlier this morning like he was going to refuse to meet Vice President Pence, changed his mind about it, but it certainly was an indication of his mindset. So let's take the camera, you know, let's take a wider perspective on America in the world right now, what our position in the world is post this episode, how this looks in Europe to the North Koreans, to the Russians, because I have a sense that this is a real inflection point, that America's role in the world, the respect, the trust that people have in us is going to be very hard to restore after what has happened in just the last few days. Do you agree or disagree?
I do. And I think an inflection point is a good way to put it. You know, during the Obama presidency, I wrote a lot about how I thought Obama had pretty much, through his monomaniacal focus on the Iran deal, through his passivity about Europe, through his, you know, fake kind of pivot to Asia that really turned out to be a pivot to nowhere, that he had really brought American foreign policy, you know, down to where it was in the mid 70s. And I was hoping that a responsible Republican administration would repair a lot of that damage. With all that said, I would take a third term of Obama to repair Trump's damage at this point. I mean, boy, think of how bad that is.
Yeah, that is something I never imagined that I would think ever.
I mean, this is the United States is now at a point where we have all of the worst things that you can say about a major power. We're weak. We are inconstant. We are a bad ally. We are poorly governed. We send conflicting signals. We don't defend our interests. We don't defend our friends. And we're basically governed by a single, again, by a cult of personality where our primary mode of foreign policy is getting on the phone and making, to use John Bolton's immortal phrase, making drug deals, you know, on the sly with foreign strongmen, and then burying the memos in a classified vault somewhere so the American people never have to know what their own president did to them in foreign policy. This is an unbelievable low in American foreign policy, and I don't know how we recover from it.
I'm trying to imagine what it must like to be a democracy activist in Hong Kong right now, anybody living in Hong Kong, anyone living in Taiwan, and frankly, I would not feel tremendously confident being an Israeli at the moment, given the president's attitude. Not to mention any of our allies in Europe, you know, who you know, and because Trump has really made no effort to hide his contempt for them. Is there any ally, anyone in the world that right now can be confident in America's word or their support? I can't think of anyone.
And
the list of people either who ought to be freaking out. I mean, the Japanese have to be looking around thinking, you know, at what point is he going to say, hey, you know, why do we have, you know, a presence in Asia? Well, you know, maybe we should withdraw from Asia, right?
Well, you know, what's really scary about this is not, I mean, in some ways, it would be less frightening if, you know, the United States had elected an America Firster who says, listen, my State Department is full of guys who are skeptical, you know, John Bolton types. We're skeptical of treaties. We're not sure about extended deterrence. We want to, you know, if you're Japan, we're going to talk with you about this. We have to renegotiate our alliance. That's something foreign countries know how to deal with. They may not like it, but they would know how to deal with it. Where we are is, if you have a problem with North Korea, one phone call from Pyongyang to Washington and I'll sell you down the river. There is no process. There is no second tier of diplomats or national security experts that our counterparts in other countries can call to say, listen, what's going on? How can we work around this? You know, what? Where's the middle ground here? Nothing. I mean, the democracy protesters, you know, if Xi Jinping calls up and says, listen, Don, this is what I want. And the president says, oh, well, you know, all you had to do was say so. That's the end of that. So, I mean, it's as I hate to bring up a painful memory for us Republicans, Charlie, but it's a far cry from the days when people were, you know, hiding and having meetings in places like Warsaw and Prague and saying Ronald Reagan is on our side. He's out there for us. We know where he stands. We know where America stands. We know where their heart is. Now it's, you know, if I go out in the street and the guy running my country makes a phone call to the United States, I'm going to end up, you know, metaphorically, I'm going to end up in a car trunk somewhere.
So we remember late last year, James Mattis resigns as Secretary of Defense, the first time this has happened in American history, as a matter of principle, objecting specifically to Donald Trump's, you know, plans at that time to withdraw from Syria. He later changed his mind. But that was a major moment in modern history where you had the Secretary of Defense said, I'm drawing the line here. I am going to resign. Given what's happening now, including the breaking of the dam with whistleblowers and other members of the Department of State who are coming forward and now testifying, this willingness now to speak up more aggressively, where are the other resignations?
Where is Mattis? You know, that's another one of those moments like you were talking about with A.B. Stoddard. That was a big deal. It was an inflection point. It was a crisis. We were all shocked. And now it's like, oh, yeah, I remember when that happened. And Mattis, who, you know, made a big deal about resigning and, you know, wrote a letter that made it very clear where he was, has decided that, well, you know, I'm going back to being a general, so I don't talk about this. And by the way, go buy my book. So if Mattis isn't going to lead the charge on this, why should anybody else? I mean, who's going to do it? McMaster? Kelly? None of these guys are going to get out there in front when Jim Mattis is providing top cover by saying, well, I'm not talking. So why should anybody else? Well, but it's interesting that the, you know, state news network over at Fox, along with the usual enablers in the conservative punditocracy, have already started. I mean, when Tucker Carlson is referring to, was it Tucker or was it Levin referring to Bolton as a man of the left? You know, they were already beginning that nonsense. John Bolton's a man of the left. He was never really with us. So, you know, I think the bigger problem here is that there is this kind of code of omerta that's holding among all these people. And I think we have to confront something really uncomfortable, that people like Mattis and others are not speaking up because deep down they don't disagree with Donald Trump that much, that they are offended by him. They think he's making some terrible mistakes. They have those aesthetic disagreements with his boorishness, but that if they let Donald Trump go down the tubes, then America falls to the socialists. I mean, this is that Flight 93 right. thinking and that has infected that all of these people.
There are some, but there's got to be this critical mass somewhere of the people who are horrified and yet afraid because they understand the price they would pay in terms of the career, reputation, just the bullshit they would have to put up with. So that's why somebody like Mattis is so important, because once a few of them come out, then I think that you're going to see them en masse do it, but nobody wants to be the first one. Nobody wants to be the first guy to stick his head in the guillotine.
But part of the problem is these are all old men. I mean, Bill Barr shrugs his shoulders and says, "I am 69. We all die." You know, Rudy's in his 70s. Wait, I want to be relevant one more time, one last hurrah. What do I care?
Okay, I got to ask you this. Okay, we've talked about this before. This totally puzzles me. That traditionally, though, when people reach a certain age, they do start thinking about their legacy. They do start thinking about how they will be remembered, what the meaning of their life was.
Well, if they are people of character, they do. But clearly, these are not people of character. I mean, you know, William Barr has decided that his, you know, he was a spear carrier at the end of one administration, and he had one shot at it. And, you know, all these years later, he's back in for one more round, and he's going to do whatever he has to do. He thinks that's his legacy. Rudy, I don't understand Rudy. I mean, for Rudy, it's, you know, one more paycheck or something. I guess when you have that much alimony to deal with, you make accommodations. I think where you are seeing some cracks, there are people who are, you know, younger, Fiona Hill, Ambassador Yovanovitch, you know, a few others, but they're not getting any top cover. They're being thrown under the bus.
But you know what? They are role models, because these are very, very impressive women. And there have to be other people in the permanent government, in the deep state, who are watching them and going, you know, that's, you know, I could do that, or I should do that, or I'm being shamed into it by their example.
Yeah, the two people, and I think it does say something for a party that, you know, prides itself on its macho bravery, that the two people that have just walked in there and obeyed those subpoenas, and in the ambassador's case, despite the direct, you know, prohibition from a guy like Pompeo, have been these two women who have gone in there and told the truth. And I think you're right. They are role models. But, you know, where's everybody else? Where are all the other people? I think one of the things that's interesting about this is there were people who got out early who thought that they got away clean. And what we're finding out now is this corruption, particularly on this Ukraine issue, goes back right to the beginning. They're all going to end up getting called back in, or at some point in their public life, they're going to be asked, what did you know and when did you know it? And they're not going to be able to, really, in a sense, they're only left with two explanations. I was part of this whole fiasco, or I was so minor and so inconsequential that nobody told me anything. And neither of those is a good answer.
Wow. Tom Echols, thank you so much. I hope I've cheered you up. No.
I don't think, yeah. It's a little early for day drinking for both of us, Charlie, but I think, you know, this is a pretty depressing. So I think these are kind of, we're in a dark moment, but I think there is yet more to come out. And I'm hopeful, as you are, that there are people that are just going to do their duty and start speaking up. So, you know, maybe there is some cause for optimism. It just seems like a tough few weeks, especially because the Democrats don't seem to be in fighting trim just yet.
Well, what disturbs me the most, I think, is just watching how the goalposts get moved all the time. And you know, to see how, you know, what is the Republican base willing to accept? You know, how far is the
anything
conservative, right, punditocracy willing to accept? And this is the real nightmare. At least in Watergate, there was an understanding that if we caught you doing A, we knew it was bad and there would be these consequences. Now you do not know what the rules are, and the moral rot that follows the revelations is just as appalling in some ways. But
knew his base better than we did, Charlie. He really can't shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, and, you know, a Barr and the rest of them will all get out and say it was a matter of national security. He had to do it.
Yeah,
so I think we just have to give up on the notion that there is any red line for the Republican base. And I think, you know, November 2020, they just have to be outvoted. And the real question is, are the Democrats really up to that job? And right now, I'm not sure I think they are.
Tom Echols, thank you for coming on the podcast again. Appreciate it very much.
Always good to talk to you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.